People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we look at Russian politics and economics with Professor David M. Kautz.
Russians had expected that when they gave up their old communist-run system and adopted capitalism, that they would experience a big improvement in their living standard. But instead, of course, the reverse has happened. It's been an unmitigated disaster.
And the U.S. Labor Party with Bob Brown.
People in your listening audience feel that everything in the world can go along and get along as it is, then probably the Labor Party is not for them. However, if any of your listening audience thinks that there's changes that need to be made in the interests of everyday, ordinary American people working and or presently unemployed, then they need to find the kind of organization that the Labor Party is.
That, plus Nelson Peary, but now these news stories from Nicole Trejo.
First, from A-Infos. The oil battles in Nigeria continue, and now the Petroleum and Gas Natural Senior Staff Association of Nigeria, PENGASN, has given the federal government a one-month ultimatum to resolve the Niger Delta crisis and make the area conducive for oil workers, or PENGASN will move their members and families out of the area. The current deadline expires in August. The association's president said in Lagos, "We have given the government 1 month to address the problem and guarantee the safety of our members. These people working in this area have been exposed to cases of arson, tribal killings, hijack, hostage-taking in the course of their daily work." PENGASN President Luoye called on Nigerian President Obasanjo to resolve the Niger Delta crisis by instituting a legislative and economic framework for a permanent solution to the inhabitants' concerns about exploitation, poverty, and brutality. In Canada, on August 7th, OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, will set up a safe park for the homeless in central Toronto. The situation facing the homeless in Toronto is at a crisis level. Emergency shelters are utterly full during the summer. With the policies of the Conservative Ontario government increasing in their impact, 5,000 people a month are being evicted in Toronto. The city has even been forced to start using rooms in the Metro Hall as places for the homeless to sleep, while at the same time, zoning and legislation is being used to push the homeless and the poor out of the metropolitan areas. And finally, in the U.S., in Seattle, Washington, international forest protection leaders have announced a global campaign to derail the World Trade Organization, WTO, plans to write trade agreements that will threaten the world's forests at the upcoming WTO ministerial here in November. The WTO is a threat to forests around the world, and the forest protection activists around the world will work to stop it, said former U.S. Congressman Jim Jontz, now executive director of the American Lands Alliance. The campaign announcement followed a forest protection summit held outside Seattle that included 40 activists from 14 countries. With such diversity and depth of experience, we are confident of ending the WTO measures that will increase consumption of forest products without any regard for the well-being of the environment, said conference organizer Victor Minotti of the International Forum on Globalization.
Thanks, Nikki. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Bob Brown of the Labor Party discusses why a political organization that represents the interests of the working class is needed in the United States.
1996 in June was the actual founding convention where 1,350 some odd delegates from unions and worker supportive organizations from around the country, from actually 48 states, including Alaska, embarked on Cleveland, Ohio, and put into motion an organization, a political party, non-electoral at that stage and continues to be at this stage non-electoral, to address issues that were of concern and were in the particular self-interest of working and poor people. That came as an effort probably 6 to 7 years prior out of what was then the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and their delegates to a convention in 1989 who asked their union to pursue other unions as well as other organizations around the country around the idea of the need for an alternative political party. That 6-7 year period resulted in that founding convention in June when it was seen that there was enough interest amongst working class organizations and organizations of the poor to begin to develop such a model. I mean, unlike Western Europe, this country basically found through the mid-1930s through the 60s the Democratic Party as a vehicle to more or less express working people's concerns. However, that political party was then, and even more so now, dominated by corporate interests. And I mean, it's become pretty clear to most people who labor for a living or who, in fact, have been thrown out of the labor market that the Democratic Party doesn't even use the word labor union anymore. At its last convention, it wasn't in any one of its convention planks, the word labor union, or union for that matter. The corporations and the concentration of wealth that is occurring through globalization has made those who run for political office in a two-party system of electoral politics beholden to those who have the money and the wherewithal to give candidates exposure through the electronic media by which people get elected. And that's dominated by corporate interests, and those who choose to run as either Republicans or Democrats are beholden to those interests that make it possible for them to run and in some cases succeed in getting elected. One barks and acts and attacks like a dog, and the other one might not bark like a dog, but certainly attacks and bites like a dog. The interests of the little guy out here, myself included, have been just lost on the scene. I mean, not even spoken to. I mean, from the late 60s until probably the mid-80s, there was lip service paid to working people, their concerns. Nothing ever delivered, but some, you know, diminishing lip service over that 15-year period. And to the point that by the mid-80s, late-80s, the Democratic Party saw, in a very conscious effort, no good reason to even pay lip service, much less not do anything as they had been doing from the mid to late 60s onward. The Labor Party and the union base out of which it was founded is a section, is not the entirety of the labor union movement, you know, have come to understand that without the kind of political unity that represents their members who are losing their jobs either by downsizing, plant closings, some form of permanent layoff, whether by attrition or otherwise, but a constantly deteriorating standard of living or a constant battle just to maintain what one has, that their very members who are in the plant one day and out of the plant the next are still the very same people, and that an organizational and educational center for politics needs to embrace both those still currently working who may not be working tomorrow and those who yesterday were laid off. So it's really a class-based party with a class perspective that's talking about its self-interest as a class of people who increasingly have little, infinitely little, or no say at all in the political process. And it's really about becoming the political organizing and educational center for those class interests at this stage of our development. Any time that you attack the bottom of any structure, you lower the entire structure. I mean, it's like taking, cutting off a rung of a ladder. The ladder gets shorter, everything moves down. What welfare reform, as signed by Bill Clinton in August of 1996, represented was a wholesale dismantling of a social security in this country that essentially is forcing labor at the bottom end to pull everything down. And it's all in the name of remaining globally competitive in the whipsawing of wages of one country versus another, the U.S. in order to try and attract investment both domestically and internationally here in this country for goods and services produced in this country needs to ratchet down its wage standards to the lowest common denominator. So it's kind of a race to the bottom globally in terms of working people to increase and maximize at an accelerated rate the profits of those who own. Unlike Western Europe, where labor parties, if you will, social democratic type parties, if you will, where they exist, in those countries, the financial and corporate interests have had a good deal tougher time in the implementation of the ratcheting down of wage scales and social programs, because they've been part of the political fabric of working people. They achieved it through real political struggle through political parties in Western European and Scandinavian countries. So they are not as far advanced in the dismantling of their social programs and wage structures as the United States is. We never had such a political party here. So our working folks have been at a loss to be able to rally and organize a resistance to those moves, and we saw how easy welfare reform was just pushed through. Class has always been with us, and in fact it was a very common term to use in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in this country. We saw an expansion of the economy in the 50s and 60s and early part of the 1970s, where most working people were fed that widespread propaganda that they were not working class anymore, that they were now middle class. Now all of a sudden there were distinctions between those who were poor and unemployed, poor who were working, and then, of course, those who were working and making a decent wage who were not working class anymore, they were middle class, and then there was the upper middle class, and all these contrived subgroupings and classes for people to think of themselves as. Well, we've lived with, really, almost 40 years of those connotations. So to bring back what was common to American working people in the 30s and 40s and early part of the 50s, and that was to know of themselves, as if you worked for somebody else, you had no doubt as to where you fell. You were working for somebody else. They owned you for the time that you worked for them. You got a wage from them. If that wage was enough to allow you and your family to survive, then you did. If it wasn't enough, you struggled to try and make it that. But you were a working class person, unless you owned or you became an agent of those who owned. Well, that got lost in that 30 to 40 year period. However, more and more people are coming to understand their economic position in society, and those who are working are, and in the Labor Party, we refer to it all the time, and folks who maybe never used the term working class in their entire life of 30, 40 years are now beginning to understand conceptually what that means, if they're working for a living, or even if they've been thrown out of the work process, but that's all they've got by which to survive is their ability to go work, they consider themselves as working class folks. And that's why I say an organizational or a political organizational and educational center is what's necessary, and that's what the Labor Party at this stage of its development hopes to be. People in your listening audience feel that everything in the world can go along and get along as it is, then probably the Labor Party is not for them. However, if any of your listening audience thinks that there's changes that need to be made in the interests of everyday, ordinary American people working and or presently unemployed, then they need to find the kind of organization that the Labor Party is in order to make a contribution and not wait for somebody else to do it for them, but to take the initiative and join up with others who are about trying to make real change in this country. The Labor Party can be reached at P.O. Box 53177, Washington, D.C., zip code 20009, and telephone number is 202-234-5190, and the fax number is 202-234-5266. That is the national headquarters of the Labor Party in Washington, D.C.
Bob Brown of the Labor Party. This is People's Tribune Radio. We spoke with David M. Kontz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Professor Kontz specializes in Russian economics and politics.
Russians had expected that when they gave up their old communist-run system and adopted capitalism, that they would experience a big improvement in their living standard. But instead, of course, the reverse has happened. Since the end of 1991, when the big transition occurred, Russia has experienced a 50% drop in its economic output as a whole. And investment in their economy has fallen by over two-thirds. It's been an unmitigated disaster. Over half of their population survives by growing a few vegetables in their backyard, and these are, this is a largely urban population. And they've followed economic policies that were urged on them by Western experts and by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And they have produced an economic disaster unprecedented in the 20th century. Unfortunately, every time a Russian government official has proposed some deviation from this disastrous set of economic policies, they have been warned that they would be cut off by the West if they did this. Can you imagine a country with 50% of its industrial capacity lying idle, and the West demands that they continue to cut public spending to make money and credit ever more scarce and to raise taxes? I mean, this is exactly the opposite to what would be considered sensible economic advice. Yet this is what is demanded of Russia.
No, you're speaking with, that boggles my mind. In essence, what is being said is, we know you're starving and we know you're dying, and the way out of this is for you to suffer more. And it's no wonder that there's a tremendous amount of resentment in Russia against the people and organizations that they see as perpetrating this misery upon them.
And that's what was really brought to the surface by the bombing of Yugoslavia. The anger was building up over these last 7 years as the economy just was wrecked, and a small number of insiders were handed the gems of the Soviet economy, and it was crystallized by this bombing campaign.
We're talking with Professor David Kontz about Russia and what's happening inside the country. Professor Kontz, I may have the numbers wrong, but somebody was explaining it to me at one point that, you're talking about 50% of Russia's manufacturing capability laying idle, and they compared that with the depression in the 30s in America, where in America it was something like maybe 10 or 20%, something like that. I mean that when you look at what that happened in the Depression, and then we see that Russia's situation is so much worse, I can begin to get an idea of just how bad it really is.
That's right. Although, the Great Depression in this country was a bit more severe than the numbers that you cited. The gross national product of the U.S. fell by about 30% from 1929 to 1933. And industrial output fell by even more. But Russia's contraction is about, it's more than 50% greater than the Great Depression. So it's still a lot more severe. But I wouldn't underplay the Great Depression of the 1930s. But just imagine, when you think of the profound effects that the Great Depression had on our society. And of course, ending it required a big increase in public involvement in the economy. Now Russia, faced with an even more severe depression, And the West says Herbert Hoover economics is what they should follow, rather than following policies like the Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. They're supposed to cut government spending even further than they've already done, which will of course only make their depression worse.
And now all of the listeners know why Professor David Kotz is the professor of economics and I'm the talk show host. Professor Kotz, what about politically in Russia, the situation now? From my perspective, the media refrains from saying it, but certainly from what I see of President Yeltsin, he certainly appears to be a fairly unstable chronic alcoholic.
That sums it up.
Yeah, I think so. What is the realities of the political situation in Russia from your perspective?
Well, President Yeltsin of Russia has been virtually a dictator these years. He was originally elected president of Russia back when it was part of the Soviet Union, but when the next election rolled around, by that time he had disbanded the Russian parliament with tanks. He and his close cronies had written a new constitution which gives essentially all political power to the presidency, and he bought his re-election in 1996 by spending hundreds of millions of dollars, which was more than 100 times what was permitted under the law. He is unstable and in bad health. The real problem, I think, is that he has followed policies which have been destroying the Russian economy and society, and creating a real ticking time bomb. It's bad enough what's been happening to the Russian people, and given that there's no reason why this had to happen. But even beyond that, it poses a tremendous danger for the world in general, and for the United States in particular. Russia is a country with many thousands of nuclear weapons, and whose military leadership has been humiliated by the loss of Russia's great power status, and whose people are outraged at the destruction of their country and society. And there is a real danger that at some point a regime will emerge in Russia that will be out for revenge, and this could spell a terrible period in world history.
Are we talking about a regime led by someone like Zhirinovsky?
Well, that would be the worst. Zhirinovsky loves to talk about Russia militarily seizing neighboring states, getting a port on the on the Mediterranean, etc. Warm war, Indian Ocean, a warm water port for Russia. But Zhirinovsky has been somewhat eclipsed in Russian politics. A greater likelihood would be General Lebed, who is still a potential contender for the Russian presidency in the election that is scheduled to take place in June of next year. And General Lebed is a little hard to read, but he does have this appeal as the general on a white horse who many Russians hope could ride into Moscow and solve all their problems by reasserting Russian power and greatness.
We've been speaking with Professor David Kotz, who's professor at the Department of Economics, University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Professor Kotz, we just have a couple of minutes left. Is there a final thought that you'd like to share with our audience about what you think we should be learning from all of what's happening and what we should be paying attention to?
Well, I think hopefully what people can learn is a greater degree of humility about America's ability to remake the world as it sees fit. The attempt to remake Russia after its image has produced a distorted version of capitalism with all of its bad features and none of its good features. The attempt to force a policy on Yugoslavia has produced the opposite of what was intended. I think a more modest approach to the world, working with our allies, working through the United Nations to do our share to help solve world problems but not try and run the world, would lead to more favorable outcomes.
Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, David M. Kotz, and now author of the book Black Fire, Nelson Peary.
What is a revolutionary today, and what do they do? I think perhaps the first thing we should do is to look at What is a revolution? Because a revolution is basically motion. The whole world is in motion, right? Everything is arising and changing and dying away and being reborn. That motion is the whole essence of life. One of the biggest questions I imagine that faces the philosophers and the revolutionaries is to try to understand why is it that things do change. Things change when their environments change. The environment that they live by, when it changes, then they have to change. If they don't change, they have to die. But in every process is the environment for another process. So the whole world is interconnected. This motion, this complex interconnection that we see throughout the world, this motion, we generally refer to it as evolution. The problem with society is that once we created a society with classes, with a ruling class and with subordinate classes, that ruling class come to the conclusion real quick, well, we don't want to change. So they've prevented society from evolving along with everything that that society depended upon, right? The process was, as far as society is concerned, was stopped. The economic environment that society lives in is an objective, real thing. Nobody can change that, and no ruling class can change the economy and the evolution of the economy that we live in. And as this contradiction between a static society on the one hand and a constantly evolving economic environment for that society, as it continues to develop, we begin to have social antagonisms. And finally, we get to the point where this antagonism creates a crisis, society breaks the restraints that the ruling class imposes upon it, and society takes a great leap forward and aligns itself accurately with the economic environment within which it lives. So we see that when we talk about revolution, essentially we're talking about evolution that takes place with leaps. At this point, the revolutionary begins to come forth. Then what is a revolutionary? Above everything else, revolutionaries are visionaries. Now, when I say vision, I don't mean dreams. So when we talk about vision, we're talking about ideas that develop on the basis of new means of production. Every time there's a change in the means of production, and every time there's a process of social disorganization, destruction, and social reconstruction, visionaries come forth and begin examining, now what is possible? The only revolutionary thing on the face of the earth is the human mind. If we don't win the human mind over, if we don't win the hearts and minds of the American people to grasping this vision that I spoke of, then all the depression and oppression and destruction in the world is not going to liberate anything. That this is the time of propagandists, a time of revolutionaries to step forth. And I might say just in closing that those of you who have or tonight might grasp that vision of a world based on electronics, on the computers, a world without backbreaking labor, a world without violence, a world dedicated to peace, if you can grasp that vision, welcome to the revolution then. Water's fine. Come on in.
That's it for this month's edition of the program. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. If you'd like more information about the League, you can call 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On behalf of Nicole Trejo, the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, and Nelson Peary, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.